let's jump into the story of the family. I mentioned last hour that you could almost think of the family as kind of a Protestant Opus Dei, or at least Opus Dei as it was presented in the movie The Da Vinci Code and the book by Dan Brown. But I'd like to know where Jeff Charlotte is on that, the author of The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism in the Heart of American Power. We'll talk about that. Just what is the goal of the family and how close they've already come to achieving it while nobody was watching? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Jeff Charlotte's book, The Family, getting a lot of attention. It's already a New York Times bestseller, and it's a really good read, Jeff. So great job both on the external research and also the internal sort of accidental undercover investigation.
Is that a good way to describe it?
Accidental undercover investigation?
Yeah, that's really just right. You know, the family begins with the story of a month I spent living with this group, the oldest and I think most influential religious fundamentalist organization in the United States. And I didn't go seeking to go undercover. I was doing my first book about unusual religious communities around the United States, and I was just invited in, and I said, that sounds interesting. And suddenly I find myself really, as I say in the subtitle, at the heart of American power.
Yeah. So we'll get more into that. Let me start by a kind of a familiar door, I think, for a lot of people on this was Opus Dei from the Da Vinci Code. And I was sort of using that as a way of describing it for people who didn't know what the book was about. So talk about that relatively, how close that is, you know, a group of religious zealots that are willing to dismiss heinous acts, crimes, as long as they're committed in the name of their goals of global domination. Was that a fair way to describe the family?
I think it is, and you know, both groups are formed in 1935. Both groups are formed by these very charismatic men with cults of personalities around them, and these guys who think that democracy is not enough, and they really venture into what I think a lot of people would say is a heresy. And both groups, the one distinction I make is I actually give more credit to Opus Dei. One member of the family, Senator Sam Brownback from Kansas, is one of the unusual members in that he's a member of the family, and yet he also converted to Catholicism, or his version of it, that is, through Opus Dei's chapel in Washington. But he didn't join, because if you're in Opus Dei, you actually, the official rules anyway, are if you're a politician, you can't become a full member of Opus Dei, because when you do, you give veto rights over your life to the organization. And they recognize that you can't do that. If you're elected by people, you have to represent those people. You can't give veto rights to a secret organization. So the politicians don't join. The family doesn't have that barrier.
Yep.
And it makes them much more
dangerous.
They're
not conflicted by that problem.
No, they think that's a good thing. Yeah, they think
yeah.
that's a good thing.
Opus Dei looks at that as being something, no, we wouldn't want you to do that to the people, but for the family, they're like, hey, perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
And the other important distinction, too, is that, you know, Opus Dei is still, whether you like it or not, it's still within Catholicism. A lot of people would say it's sort of a heresy. The family is teaching something that has very little relationship to Christianity, as most of us recognize it.
Well, we'll talk more about that. And I will confess this. I got about halfway through the book. So I'm looking forward to sort of exploring that back half with you here on Coast to Coast. I loved how you set the table for the current events by going back into sort of the history of the theology of this thought of this sort of the operating ethos of this group, the family. If the fact that you made this connection with Opus Dei entirely on your own doesn't surprise me. I just hadn't gotten to that part yet. So thank you for more on that. And I look forward to finishing, because it's so interesting to consider what's been going on. They would not say, the family would not say it's secret. They would just say it's private. Talk about that.
Well, actually, the word that they like to use most often is invisible. When I was living with them, one night I was given documents as I was sort of getting deeper into it. And maintaining the finest invisible organization. And, I did this book by living with them and then spending years in an archive of papers that they had dumped. And so those documents are actually all there for review. Anyone can look at them. They speak of creating what they call a publicly invisible but privately identifiable group of companions, of powerful men who are bound together. And that language repeats itself over and over. The leader of this group, this man named Doug Coe, says, "We want to be like the mafia." And this is a direct quote. This is actually a sermon you can hear online, which is not the brightest thing that they've ever done. Is that the more invisible you can make your organization, the more influence it will have. So this is this word that they return to again and again, this idea of invisibility and influence.
Yeah, I kind of threw that word, the underworld, out with that in mind, this sort of fascination that they have with the mafia in the family. But also, and to make this connection again with Opus Dei, also with fascism. And I'm not saying that Opus Dei is a fascist organization, but they certainly walked hand in hand with Generalissimo Franco in the Francoist government, right, of Spain. And so it makes you wonder when you look at if Opus Dei was willing to make those kind of moral compromises with Franco, it's not too surprising that the folks in the family, this political organization that we'll get more into tonight on Coast to Coast, but this group, sort of from the very beginning, admits to a fascination with successful fascist regimes of the past, not excluding Hitler.
Yeah, not excluding Hitler, but especially Hitler. When I was living with the group, you know, that was the first thing that caught my attention, was a almost daily drumbeat of saying, a model for understanding Jesus, they would say, is Hitler or Stalin or Mao. They said, these are evil men, but look, they were Christianity has got Jesus all wrong. Jesus is actually this sort of strong man like Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. And it's funny that you mentioned Franco. This is something I didn't have room to fit in the book, but their relationship with Franco, Spain, this dictator in Spain who killed a lot of people. One thing he didn't like the family. He wasn't interested in them for a variety of reasons. Until the family was able to make connection with Opus Dei associates in his government, and through those connections, build this relationship to this dictator, which then became a very fruitful relationship for them.
That notion too, and I am reminded of the Hitlerian model of these cell groups, these wolf packs, these small groups of people that were unaware perhaps of they could be in a room of eight and four would not know that the other four were also in a group connected, that these cell groups were operating at a level that helped achieve the greater goal, but with this level of secrecy, of invisibility. So, I mean, as this organization is built from the very beginning, the family, starting in the early part of the 20th century, this idea of cells, of developing groups everywhere, all over the world, it takes hold right away. I mean, in the early years, this was part of their blueprint, and they put their blueprint to work immediately.
They really did, and they began back in 1935, and when they began, it was with a specific idea that democracy was finished. It couldn't compete with communism or fascism. They didn't want to be communist. They looked at fascism, and that seemed okay to them, but they wanted a more supernatural fascism, and they began applying that, and yet they were very successful at moving it into the mainstream, so successful that by 1942, they had a number of congressmen who were involved with the group and very openly committed to the idea that democracy was passed. We are entering what the founder of the group called the age of minority control, and that's an idea they believe in to this day, that they're not interested in democracy. They're interested in the age of minority control.
The minority,
by that they mean a small group, right, of men, not any particular ethnic group or anything like that. Yeah.
And so their admiration for fascism is built on the assumption that they would be the ones at the oligarchical top of fascism. That they're not the ones at the bottom. They're the ones at the top. That's how they saw their future.
They call themselves the new chosen. They believe that God has selected them for leadership. And And that God, I mean, it begins one night, April 1935. This found a fairly prominent preacher at that point. Up to that point, a fairly conventional conservative preacher, but nothing unusual or unacceptable about what he's doing. In the middle of the night, he believes that God comes to him and gives him a new revelation, saying that Christianity has gotten it wrong for 2,000 years. That Christianity has been focusing on helping the poor and the suffering and the weak and the down and out. That's not what God wants. What God wants, according to this guy, is for him to be a missionary to and for the powerful. That God announces to him, I am going to select a few powerful men, and I will work through them. And that Jesus' message was not actually meant for everybody. It was meant only for a special elite who would be given power to sort of carry it out, kind of on the rest of us.
I kind of buy that to a point. I believe that the powerful deserve a ministry just like anybody else does. It's sort of,
oh, sure, of course,
based on the same principle that, you know, hot chicks need love too. You know, I mean, that's sort of a, right? I mean, there's kind of an idea that there's a, that everybody deserves to have peace and joy. But that notion gets so twisted right away, it seems, when...
Believe everyone deserves him. It's not that they think the powerful need a ministry, too. They think the powerful are the only ones who need a ministry.
Okay.
And that if you work through the powerful, that God will reveal these sort of special teachings to the powerful. And not only that, that God is going to... give this sort of set of false teachings for the rest of us just to keep us content. I mean, this is Gnosticism. This is that old tradition of Gnosticism.
Right, the knowing ones.
Exactly. Right. What Plato called the noble lie, the idea that the masses can't handle the truth and that there's a certain group are going to have it, and that, that they're the only ones who need this direct relationship with God, and that they can then decide what's best for the rest of us. So it's a little bit of a sort of a trickle-down kind of approach to religion.
That kind of built-in elitism that was also associated with Opus Dei. You know, don't worry, the smart people have it all here. We got it all. We got it under control. Don't worry. Everything's going to be fine. We're talking about the book The Family with Jeff Charlotte, and it explores the secret fundamentalism at the heart of American power. And we'll get into who those powerful people are and have been, who's a member of the family, and more specifically about some of these beliefs of this group, that the C Street group. But before we go there, again, let's go over a little bit more about the sort of the foundational history of the family. And the early successes came, you said, they had congressmen who were pretty much in their hip pocket by the early 1940s. Didn't at some point after democracy triumphed over fascism in World War II, did they not have, if you'll pardon the expression, kind of a come to Jesus meeting about the idea that maybe fascism didn't work? And hey, how about this? Democracy won.
Well, you know, one would have hoped, and in fact, but it was really in some ways just the opposite. By the end of World War II, they had enough influence in Washington that the leader of the group, Abraham Baraity, was able to sort of finagle military transport to Germany, the cooperation of the Allied government, and he went through the Allied prisons of the Nazi war criminals, interviewing them and looking for men who would be, from his perspective, suitable for not exactly rehabilitation. All they had to do was sort of switch out their allegiance to the Führer for our Father, that is not the God that you and I might be familiar with from American religion, but this very peculiar idea he had. And, you know, and among those men was a man named Baron Ulrich von Ginnanth, who had been the head of the Gestapo in the United States, had been deported, had never repented for what he had done. And Abram thought this was such a good guy. He lobbied for him to get a passport into the United States. The United States would never go quite that far. So the family instead began sending him delegations of U.S. congressmen who were sort of gather around the great man's knee and learn lessons directly from Baron Ulrich von Ginnanth. They look at what comes ahead. You know, World War II is over, but they look at the Cold War coming and they say, well, not time for democracy now. If anything, it's time to get tougher and time to start seeking out foreign dictators with whom we can forge these alliances.
Well, and I understand forging alliances and building an international organization, but But again, you know, then they take on, then if the next battle is the Cold War and communism, you would think that after, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union and the failure of the of Chinese communism to the point where they had to add in capitalism in order to make communism work in China, you would think still they would say, hey, how about this? Democracy does work. We keep betting on the wrong pony here.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of like someone is trying to teach them a lesson from above, and they're really not getting it. It's true. I mean, but that's what I think it really reveals, the fundamental nature of the group. And here I'm just using their own language. I do, when writing about different sorts of beliefs, it's important to really not characterize them for them, but to look at what they believe. They look at the New Testament, and where most of us would read the New Testament and see a message of love or mercy or justice or forgiveness, whether or not we're Christians, that's, you know, I think most of us recognize that, they really believe that what the New Testament is about is power. When I began reporting this book, I actually sat in on a counseling session between the leader of the group and a congressman from Kansas named Todd Tehart. And Todd Tehart came in with a sort of pretty standard set of issues that he was concerned about. And the leader of the group said, no, you got to put that away. He says, what we want is a covenant between powerful men who are bound together by serving God. And I said, now, you may think you know who God is, but let me explain to who God is. He says, look at Hitler. Look at Pol Pot. Osama bin Laden, Lenin, that's what we're going for. That model of strength, the power cult.
Wow. Well, then, who is in the family? Who do we know has been in the family historically? Who is in there now? The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. That's the subtitle of the new book from Jeff Charlotte. And then when we return to the subject, I want to talk about the crimes. You know, I don't want to toss that around and not back that up. So what are the things that the family feels were sort of justifiable crimes, or even just philosophically, if X were to happen, it wouldn't be so bad as long as it was in the name of Christ, or at least the Christ that they believe is the one that they are entitled to, the one that they would worship, the powerful Christ, the kind of fascist Christ that Hitler would have imagined as well. The family, the secret fundamentalism at the heart of American power, coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Jeff Charlotte's book, The Family, certainly stirring up trouble for what had been a private / secret, hope to be invisible organization of Christian fundamentalists that were part of their own, you know, mandate would say, try to control the world, to try to be the ones at the top of the power pyramid, as they feel like they have had these private revelations as to what the purpose of God and or religion is all about. In fact, before we go any further into who, again, lay out, if you could, the beliefs. What is it that they believe that their unique revelation tells them? What's the difference between their God and, say, my God?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because although, you know, on the surface they might look like a Christian fundamentalism, I've actually been really heartened by the fact that I've been joined in investigating them by some very prominent Christian right figures, a magazine called World Magazine, a Christian right magazine. And building on my research just this past month, they've launched their own investigation. And I think what they are finding, Christian fundamentalists are looking at this group and saying, hey, this isn't Christianity. This is a power cult. This is this group that has this idea that God had a sort of set of special secret teachings for the very powerful few, the new chosen, as they call themselves, and that they're modeled not on love or mercy or any of these kinds of good things that most of us think of as part of religion, but on this really just bald fetishization for power, for authoritarianism. And that's why the family constantly invokes, as leadership models, these horrible figures like Hitler and Mao. Doug Coe, the leader of the group, He says, you think you understand Jesus. Let me tell you what I mean by Jesus. He says, you know how Jesus said you got to put me before your mother, father, brother, sister. This is a scripture verse. He says, well, Hitler and Mao, that's what they taught the kids. Mao even had the kids killing their own parents, but it wasn't murder, you see, because it was for building the new nation. It was for building the new kingdom.
And that's a quote. And that's a quote.
That's a direct quote. Actually, I did a segment on this with NBC Nightly News last year, and the family, which very rarely responds to anything, did put forth a spokesman who tried to defend that kind of language by saying, well, you know, we just use Hitler as a metaphor. And you want to say, you can't think of a better metaphor for Jesus than Hitler? Let's start with a lamb, perhaps.
Bible is full of metaphors for Jesus.
I don't think Hitler's in there. Well, I'll go back and check, but I'm pretty sure he's not in there.
That's scary. So again, though, their version is that God is has this new chosen, this new power elite, and that they are ordained to do whatever they feel is necessary to bring this vision of what they feel God is calling them to do into reality.
Yeah, and another way that they differ from what we might call Christian fundamentalism, the way that they're not, is, you know, there's this idea very popular among some people that Christ might be coming back any day. They don't believe that. The core group doesn't believe that. They believe that the particular Christ who that they are interested in, and again, not recognizable, I want to emphasize that to all, you know, our Christian listeners out there. We're not talking about your God. We're talking about something very different. This God, though, doesn't come back until they've established 1,000 years of government according to his order through them. So they've got a long, long-term project, and that justifies an any means necessary approach to politics.
1,000 years. We've heard that before. 1,000 years. 1,000 years of a Reich government. Yeah, 1,000. Funny how that really is interesting. They really are kind of obsessed with this sort of Hitlerian model then, that there would be 1,000 years of their rule, and then God would come back?
Yeah, well, I mean, even in the early days, they said, you know, back in the early days, they were a little more plain about the relationship to fascism. They said, we are seeking a fascist dictatorship for God. And even now, they still speak in terms of what they sometimes call the totalitarianism of Christ. And any serious Christian person hears that phrase and they say, that makes no sense. There's no totalitarianism is anti-Christian. Christ isn't totalitarian. Christ is loving, right? So, you know, they take the sort of the veneer of a world religion, which has this great tradition, but they bend it toward this very ugly, very darkest conception of power.
So now, with that fresh in our minds, let's talk about the people who we know both historically and in current events that are at the heart of the family, people who would not renounce their relationship with the family, people who would attribute their success to the family. Who would those be?
It's a surprising list, but let's start with the three who put the family in the news this summer. Senator John Ensign of Nevada, Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina, and Congressman Chip Pickering of Mississippi. Three men who, to the public, have long proclaimed their commitment to small-ass family values, you know, being honest and being forthright and, a certain kind of moral standard. And as we learned this summer, we're all carrying on secret affairs and really pretty awful secret affairs, except Governor Sanford. He fell in love. He says he's a different case.
Right. It's his soulmate, dude.
It's his soulmate. We don't want to bust on him. That, right? But what disturbed at is that they're all linked to a ministry that the family runs called the C Street House in Capitol Hill. This is a former convent. They register as at a church, even though the leader of the group says he hates church. But what that allows them to do is be tax exempt, and then they can provide below market housing to congressmen, just like a lobbyist. And Senator Ensign has been living there for 7 years. I met him there. Governor Sanford went for counseling with his affair, and of course they helped him cover it up. Senator Ensign, we now learn, through his brothers in the C Street house, managed to cover up his affair for months or maybe a year. They actually, according to allegations, encouraged him to pay off his mistress, to pay for her silence, to pay her husband. I mean, this comes awfully close to what we would call pimping. But right. The family considered that justified because Senator Ensign, and from their perspective, has been chosen for power by God. So anything we need to do to protect him, they'll do. The worst was really Congressman Chip Pickering of Mississippi. And, you know, people out there might say, hey, that's my pop, my representative, I like him, and so on. We're not talking about their public records. We're talking about what they do behind closed doors. Pickering, according to his wife, who's filing for divorce, Mississippians know this. She's been a long-suffering woman. She's finally fed up with her husband's womanizing. Pickering wasn't just using the C Street house to cover up his affair. He was actually conducting his affair in the C Street house, this building right there in Capitol Hill, registered as a church, this $2 million townhouse. So these three guys have been in the news, but they've been helped by some others. Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma was allegedly the man who advised Senator Ensign that he should pay his mistress's family $1.2 million.
Right.
You know, the list goes on.
Well, let's go to James Inhofe, who's also from Oklahoma, isn't he?
Indeed, yeah. Oklahoma's got a bit of a track
right.
record
so
with this organization.
Both of their senators are in the family.
And Senator Don Nichols, before them, was involved. Representative Steve Largent, who is also from Oklahoma. A lot of these guys. Senator Sam Brownback from Kansas allowed me actually to spend time with him. I also write for Rolling Stone magazine, and so I traveled with Brownback for Rolling Stone magazine in Washington and Kansas, and his whole career has been made through the family from when he was a young guy first coming to Washington, needed a place to stay, and the family said, "Here, we'll set you up," and
right.
They had their hooks in from very early on.
Well, then let's go. Then we got Senator Tom Coburn, Senator John Ensign. Who did we mention? And we mentioned Inhofe.
But Jim DeMint also, Senator Jim DeMint from South Carolina has been living in the C Street House for many years. He says it's a way of providing accountability. But then we got to ask what kind of accountability happens behind closed doors. And they really do say that. Congressman Zach Womp of Tennessee has been living in the C Street House for 12 years. Says, well, we have to keep it secret. He actually told when all this came out this summer, he says, we have to keep it secret because no one would be involved if it wasn't secret. So we have to go behind closed doors.
Yeah, that's so. Don't they get that? That if that, that's just like any criminal organization. Well, if people knew we were in it, we couldn't be in it. I mean, it just doesn't make it. I mean, that should be like a little red flag that goes.
Exactly. And you got to say, you know, wait a minute, you have to keep it secret. Are you telling me because the American people won't support a politician they feel has a good relationship with God? I don't think so.
That's not the problem. That's not the problem.
Exactly. So, well, these guys, because what they realize, and this is what happened with this Christian Right magazine, which I have great admiration for, called World Magazine. They did an investigation. They called up all these politicians who you would think would be thrilled to be in this magazine. They said, tell us about your relationship. And they all said, we can't speak about it. And that's because, according to the family's own documents, when you enter into what they call a cell, you sign you pledge yourself to an oath of secrecy. You don't speak about what your brothers in the cell do, even if, as in the case of Senator Ensign and Governor Sanford and so on, they're betraying the public trust. Senator Ensign, we now know, may have actually committed a felony. There's going to be an investigation and its misuse of campaign funds to cover up his affair. And his brothers not only didn't speak about it, they helped him cover it up.
Okay. So the first rule of Fight Club is never talk about Fight Club. So Tom Coburn, John Ensign, Jim DeMint, we mentioned Brownback. Steve Largent,
Todd Hart from Kansas, Joe Pitts from Pennsylvania, Frank Wolf from Virginia, Robert Adderhall from Alabama. It's sounding at this point, some people are out there saying, hey, this sounds like all Republicans. I hope this guy isn't bashing Republicans, and I am certainly not. There's Democrats involved too. Senator Mark Pryor of Arkansas has been involved, although now he is denying it. Congressman Bart Stupak, a Democrat of Michigan, has been living in the family family's C Street house for 7 years. And now when the scandal broke, the Michigan press said, hey, what's this all about? And he says, gee, I don't know. He's been getting below market housing, basically subsidized housing from this group for 7 years, living in the house. And I've been in the house. I know what goes on in that house. And he's now claiming that he basically closed his eyes and plugged his ears whenever he was there for 7 years, even though back in 2002, he told the Los Angeles Times, when they asked him about his involvement, he says, oh, it's secret. I can't tell you.
I saw on a list Norm Coleman, the former senator from Minnesota, and he's Jewish.
Yeah, I don't, you know, unfortunately, sometimes people take my research and run with it. I don't know anything about Norm Coleman, so I wouldn't say anything about that.
But I do. I know him. And so it surprised me when he was listed as a former resident at C Street.
Oh, I don't believe he is. No, I think
okay.
I think that's a mistake. I think, right. Well, you know, one of the things that I'm very careful with in this research, and I think is very important, we have in the United States a history of something called McCarthyism, you know, where people start throwing allegations around widely.
And right.
So I don't describe anyone as involved in this unless, say, as in the case of Senator Ensign, I spent time with him at the C Street House, or Congressman Tehart. I sat in and I listened to him on a session where he was learning about this, or former Attorney General Ed Meese, who runs a weekly meeting there, or working through the family's own archive, 600 boxes of documents. If I have documentation, then I can say, hey, this person's involved. Here is the papers.
Right.
Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, I have documents going back to the 80s of him meeting with a dictator named Siad Barre, was the dictator of Somalia, and doing so on behalf of the family. Senator Jim Inhofe, there's actually a little video you can see online where he talks about how he uses his status as a senator to sort of open doors overseas and not represent American interests, but to represent what he calls, quote, the political philosophy of Jesus. A lot of people would say Jesus' philosophy is not political. They say the political philosophy of Jesus as taught to him by Doug Coe, and he does so on the public dime. He actually bragged about using funds of the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee, money that is supposed to be there for looking out for the interests of the men and women in our fighting forces. He's using that to promote this very private, very unusual agenda overseas.
We're talking about The Family, the new book out by Jeff Charlotte, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. I wikied that the C Street Group, which was one of the places that the family has a residence that is open to members, the other being the Cedars, and we'll talk more about that coming up in the next hour. But when I went to Wiki, it said Susan Collins has been a resident at C Street. I thought C Street was a male-only thing.
This is really, I think what's happening now, unfortunately, is some people are, whether they have a political
agenda
with a certain politician,
right,
are trying to tar him by association. The other thing that's happening is,
yeah, but Susan Collins, I mean, she's like one of the most liberal Republicans.
It's very moderate, and
it doesn't even
fit.
She's a
woman, and the C Street House,
right?
I mean, you have even Michael Cromarty, who's a Christian conservative guy, but honest on this score, at least, says the C Street House is like a fundamentalist rat house. Susan Collins is not welcome.
Where you could bring your girlfriend.
Well, you can bring a girlfriend or your mistress,
exactly. That this doesn't make any sense. And in fact, I wondered about that at the time when you were talking about Pickering bringing in his mistress, according to the divorce papers, with his wife. And didn't some of the members? What's that?
That hasn't been denied. I mean,
that hasn't been denied.
Yeah.
But I mean, you didn't, in the case of John Ensign, senator from Nevada. Wasn't it some of the guys in C Street Group, in the family, tried to talk him out of it, said, you really don't want to do this. You want to stop this. He didn't right away, but they were encouraging him on a one-to-one basis to drop his girlfriend. Is that right? Does that sound right?
Yes, that's right, but you got to put that in the context in which they say, even if you don't, you still deserve to be in power, and I hear the music, so maybe I can give you a little context on the other side.
All right, we'll do context on the other side, coming up with Jeff Charlotte. And we'll talk about that. The consequences of breaking the rules, and how is one chosen? I talk about the members of the family, this Christian-inspired political organization. They consider themselves the new chosen, which gives them all sorts of latitude in what they feel like they can do, both with their role as a servant of the people, but also as a servant of the world, and what they can do, what kind of arrangements they can make, what they feel like there is their, what there is in their purview. How are they chosen? What does one do in order to be revealed as one of the new chosen? We'll talk about that, too. And we'll get back to the subject of some of the other crimes next, too, on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We're doing a story tonight on the family, Jeff Charlotte's new book. It's fascinating. It's easy to read. It lays out both the history of the organization and also the sort of philosophical slash theological understanding behind the family, the secret fundamentalism at the heart of American power. But that's not just the whole story. Actually, it's not just American power, it's international power. We'll talk more about that too. Some of the other countries whose leaders are members of the family. And just how much power does this organization have? We'll put on our list of subjects to get back to coming up this hour, past evidence of when the family has flexed its muscle, what it's been able to do just because it decided to do it, regardless of whether it was in the best interest of the United States or anybody's interest other than their own. What have they been able to do? Or is this just an organization with a lot of dreams, but not any real way of achieving them? We'll also get back to where we left off at the top of the hour. They're talking about the members of the C Street group, kind of a who's who of senators and congressmen, a couple Democrats, mostly Republican, who are dedicated to the family. So dedicated are they that when asked about their below market value housing that they're given, they said, well, it's a secret. I can't tell you. It's a secret in a democracy. From elected people. We'll get back to this. Just what is it? What does it mean to be part of the new chosen? And how is one chosen? How is one determined to be one who receives this special revelation of God? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Let's go back real quickly to something which we just touched on toward the end of last hour. There are a couple of different places that the family maintains. We're talking with Jeff Charlotte, the author of The Family, and the C Street house is just one of them. Mention some of the other places that they also own.
Well, there's a nearly $7 million mansion in Arlington called The Cedars. It's at the end of a cul-de-sac. Arlington, Virginia is a neighborhood for those not familiar with that area. It's very close to the Pentagon, close to the CIA, and a lot of career folks live there. This is actually registered as a safe house with the CIA. It's a beautiful white-pillared mansion overlooking the Potomac. They've carved a waterfall into the front lawn. They actually built up, they drew up blueprints for an underground bunker, which they never ended up building. But it gives you a sense of their view of the world. It was going to be a chapel, but unlike most chapels, it was going to be circular with concentric rings of access to power. And in the middle of it was going to be the leader of the group, Doug Coase, real cult of personality. Around that, there's a number of houses that serve it. There's a house called Potomac Point for young women who serve the Cedars. Women are not expected to have any kind of leadership roles. They're expected to be submissive. About 20 properties in the neighborhood, including one called Ivanwald, which is a house for young men who were being groomed for leadership. And I spent about a month, a little less than a month, living there. There's another set of houses like that in Annapolis. And then when you start going overseas, you start seeing properties that have been given to them by the leaders of foreign governments. So one of their real early successes was with the late Ethiopian dictator Haile Selassie, who deeded them a fabulous property right near his palace in downtown Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. But, I mean, that's just one example. It's really very international group and has always seen their mandate as not just covering up affairs for their members like Senator Hinton and so on, but really seeking a certain kind of power internationally.
Right. And I'll get back to the Senator Ensign story and how that cover-up and how this relates to the family, but I had to make a note. So there's like a list somewhere of registered safe houses with the CIA, and how safe can those houses be?
No, you know, the interesting thing of it, the safe house, first of all, they're not terribly safe. A safe house is not as sort of skull and bones as it sounds. A safe house, a CIA safe house or a government safe house simply means a place to which members of the government can retreat if something was to go wrong in Washington, if they had to, for instance, evacuate the city or something like that. And the way I found this out, actually, and this was sort of a fascinating sort of side excursion. So there's about these 20 houses in this neighborhood. Well, it turns out the family, among other things, are very bad neighbors, and they offended all the women of this neighborhood. And these women banded together and started investigating, and they were some women who knew how to investigate. One is a professor of investigative journalism at George Washington. Another was a retired anthropologist. Another is a very high-up Pentagon official herself. She was the one who managed to get a hold of the blueprints for the bunker. The professor of investigative journalism was the one who was able to discover that this had been listed as a safe house. Now, you don't want to make too much of that. What's more significant is the fact that this is the $7 million mansion paid for with donations given to them by the CEOs of leading defense companies and oil companies, and they're using it to conduct private meetings with foreign leaders, which is illegal, technically, but more importantly, to sort of indoctrinate their members who... I think a lot of them really join with the best of intentions. A lot of politicians get involved because this sounds like a good thing. But they get indoctrinated in this idea, this very cultish kind of Gnostic approach to religion that says that there are secret teachings. And the secret teachings are not about any of the wonderful things of Christianity, like love or mercy or justice or forgiveness. It's about power and who God wants to have it and who God doesn't want to have it.
Okay. Always good. Love how you're presenting this material. It's just this interesting in the book, too, for people who want to pick up a copy. You can link up to it through coasttocoastam.com. But, Jeff Charlotte, that also sounds kind of Masonic, that idea of the secret rings of power, the knowing ones, working one's way up to the top of the power pyramid. I mean, that's all very much a Masonic model, too.
It is, except, the difference is, I don't know a whole lot about the Masons. I think that, as far as I can tell, it seems to be a pretty innocuous, club of guys who like to get together and so on, and have, these sort of fun and games. The family is something quite different because they begin from the very beginning as a political organization. Their first meeting takes place in Seattle, Washington, in 1935. And it's a political meeting. The founder gathers 19 wealthy businessmen, and they sit around, and they wait for God to give them a message, and God does. He gives to a young lawyer named Arthur Langley, stands up and says, "I've been selected by God to be the next mayor of Seattle and then the governor of Washington." The 19 businessmen pledge to put their money behind him, a guy named Arthur Langley. This did indeed happen, and this guy... this is not a conservative liberal issue because both the Republican Party, which he ended up capturing the nomination for, but both the Republicans and the Democrats denounced him for secrecy and fascism. He campaigned with an organization called the New Order of Cincinnatus, and these guys, they really liked the brown shirts. They wore white shirts and green hats, and they did, at one point they were doing seagull salutes. Sort of a funny document I found in their archives is when they decided not to do seagull salutes, because they decided that was too fascist, as opposed to just fascist enough.
Yeah, it was just, as he walked past for them to go, "Zeke, Heil," that was just a little over the line.
That was over the line. So, I mean, this group, this isn't the Freemasons, because this group begins with this idea of power, but also because they have such a disturbing idea of what it means to be chosen. We were talking about that before the break, and if I could give you one example, which I think is very telling. David Coe, he is the longtime leader of the group, sometimes referred to as First Brothers, a man named Doug Coe. he's in his early 80s. His son, one of his sons, David Coe, sort of heir apparent to the group. David Coe has been in the news, actually, as a spiritual advisor to Senator John Ensign. Let me give you an example of the kind of spiritual advice he gives. When I was living with the group, David Coe came around. He wanted to talk to us about the King David story. That's also been in the news. Remember, Mark Sanford of South Carolina said he wasn't going to resign because he's like King David. So we know modesty is not a virtue for these guys. And here's what they mean by King David. It's a core teaching of the family. He says, why do we, speaking to a group of men, says, why do we respect King David? And one guy says, because, you know, he had a great heart for God. And David Coe says, no, that's not it. Another guy says, because he was a very good man. He tried to be a good man. David Coe says, no, that's not it. He says, King David's a terrible man. He says, King David, and we remember our Bible, seduces Bathsheba and then arranges to have her husband killed. Now, he's, of course, ignoring the rest of the story in which King David learns, you know, what he's done and so on. He's only interested in that part. And he says, and yet God still likes this guy. So that's what it means to be chosen. He says, let me give you a contemporary example. He turns to one of the young men. He says, suppose I hear you raped three little girls. What would I think of you? And this guy, who is, you know, a human being, says, you'd think I was awful. You'd think I was a monster. And David Coe says, no, I wouldn't, because you're chosen. That's what it means to be chosen. Now, it's important to make the distinction. They're not telling you to go rape three little girls. They're not telling you to do these horrible things. But if you do, it doesn't matter. You're still chosen for power. And when you take that overseas and the kind of killers that they've aligned themselves with, Papa Doc Duvalier, Zahardo, these men who killed so many of their own people, you start to see what they mean when they say,
right,
the rules don't apply to our members.
Yeah, this idea about the new chosen, how is one chosen to be chosen? Or how does one prove oneself as having already been chosen yet unrevealed yet to the group as already chosen? How does that work?
Well, there's no application. You can't say, hey, you know, I think I'm chosen. Could you set me up with a seat in Congress? Doug Coe, the leader of the group, says we work with power where we can, build new power where we can't. That's historically been their role. They are interested in strong men. So what they look around is they look around the world, and if you're already in power, well, that's a pretty good sign that you're chosen. If you're already wealthy, that's an even better sign that you're chosen, because one of the things that they believe in is they sometimes call it biblical capitalism. I think some of my conservative friends over at the Cato Institute say call it crony capitalism, which, you know, the rich help each other. They believe that God has chosen who he wants to be rich and who he wants to be poor, and that we should just accept that. If things aren't going well for you financially, that's what God wants to have for you. And he does, however, want these very few rich men to be very, very rich and to decide things for the rest of us. So they say, look, God has already revealed to us. Now, this is, by the way, Christian listeners out there recognize this is heresy. This is not.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, that's kind of the prosperity gospel Calvinism that's been going around for a long time. Calvin believed in that belief. John Calvin did that somehow what your status was reflected of your specialness.
It's true enough, but this is dumb. This is really dumbed down Calvinism.
Okay,
and it goes beyond that, because of course being chosen is all about power. It's not about Calvin. You know, Calvin was a Christian. You did have to be, you know, you did have to believe in Christianity. Some of the men that they consider chosen, one of the stories I tell in the book is that of this dictator I mentioned, Siad Barre, the former dictator of Somalia. And this may seem far away and esoteric to us, but think about how in the news we've been hearing about piracy in Somalia. Think about how we
right.
hear that Somalia is now a haven for Al-Qaeda, and we want to ask ourselves,
right.
how did it get to be like this? What happened to this country that it got so demolished? Well, we go back into the family's archives, and we discovered that in early 80s, they decided that the dictator of Somalia, Siad Barre, was chosen for Africa by God. Now, this is an odd choice. Siad Barre was not a Christian by a long shot. He described himself as a Quranic Marxist. He hung pictures all throughout the country of himself, Muhammad, and Marx. But one thing that he had in common with them was a real just sort of admiration for brute strength. They started sending Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, a defense contractor named Bill Brehm, over to pray with him. Barry was a terribly cynical man. He said, "I will pray to Jesus. In return, I want something from you." He says, "I want my defense budget doubled." He says, "I want meetings with the White House for my officials. And I want a no-holds-barred, or I want the United States to look the other way while I crack down on some rebels." Well, Doug Coe, the leader of the group, he arranged this. One thing he did is he arranged in 1983, and this is documented, for Somalia's Minister of Defense to meet with the then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of the Staff. This is the kind of access they had, a guy named General John J. Vesey. Somalia's defense budget was nearly doubled, and Barre used it to wage one of the most violent, horrific, a war of biblical proportion on his own people, from which it has never recovered. The only moment of unity this country has had is when they all rose up and chased this murderous lunatic out, and the family helped him find refuge in Kenya, and they never said that he was anything but chosen for God, because they look at that and they say, well, that must be what God wants for Somalia. Not any God that I think most of us can recognize.
Fascinating. And so I think I would like accept this idea of chosen if there were some sort of divine initiation. You know, if they had to like pull a sword out of a stone or something that proved that they that there is something going on. But really comes right down to it is, you were invited to go to Ivanwald, which was one of their, if you will, what kind of like their double-A farm team kind of house?
I was a minor league player.
To look for future prospects. If you were invited, well, first of all, did the person who invite you, is after now that you've written this expose on the family, are they sitting around going, stupid, stupid, stupid? Like, how do we let him in? And if you were invited in, then how hard would it be to end up in the group of the chosen?
Well,
you could have, right? If you played your cards right, you could have been chosen.
I didn't play my cards. It was sort of a set of circumstances.
I'm not saying stupid,
because I'm still a member. I'm chosen for life, whether I want to or not, and they're very clear about this. I'm still a brother.
Wait. You're still a member of the family?
As far as they're concerned, I'm a brother. I'm a bad brother. And they told me this. You know, when I wrote about this for a magazine called Harper's Magazine, and they said, you got everything right. The only rule you broke was you weren't supposed to tell anyone. And they've emphasized this again and again. That's why Senator Sam Brownback gave me access, is he thought I was going to come back to the organization. I tell a story later in the book. I'm sitting around one day. I get this call from this man named Greg Unum. He's an executive with an international sort of oil company called Pride Former. He was calling from Angola in Africa. He said he just wanted to tell me he liked my writing. I don't get calls like that every day.
Right.
And someone calling from Angola, oil executive, saying, hey, buddy, just like your writing. As we sat and talked for a while, it turns out that Greg had been very involved with the group, and that what he was really doing was telling me, you know what, I should come back. I should come back to the fold. This could be very, very good for my career if I came back to the fold. They could help me. So from their perspective, I was involved. Now, you know, the way I got in, I tell this story in the beginning of the book. This an old friend of mine, her brother, had left his career, left his relationship to go move to Arlington, to be Arlington, Virginia, to be a part of this. And this family, conservative Christians, they weren't going to be offended by that. That was no problem for them, but this didn't seem right. And they were worried that he had joined a cult. Because I write a lot about religion, they asked if I could meet with him, I did. And he said for me to understand what he was involved in, I really had to see it myself. And so I went, and I lived with him. That's the only way you get in, is by invitation. There were some reasons. Ivanwald, the house I lived in, was mostly sort of young men in 20s, couple in the early 30s, from affluent families. With that kind of support, they liked me partly because I was a writer. They saw I was an influencer, they thought that I would be a good person to have. And so that's how I became a member and remain a member The rule I'm breaking, though, is in sharing the secrets with the world.
Nobody talks about Fight Club. So we'll come back to the story of the family then, and we left a couple of threads that we need to tie together before we get to your calls coming up at the top of the hour. And I want to talk about some of the things that they've looked the other way on. Jeff Charlotte has mentioned a few of them already internationally. What about domestically? And then what about the courts? Who do they have in our judicial system that are members of the family? And then let's get back to, we kind of teased it and then we didn't really talk more about it, about covering up crimes when they know they've been committed, or if not crimes and infidelities, and how far out of the way the family will go for you to make sure that you stay in power. Because after all, that's the most important thing to the family. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Whatever we don't get to, I hope you will address it coming up next hour when we get to some calls on Coast to Coast AM. Jeff Charlotte, the author of The Family, hot new book. How well is this book selling exactly? Do you know?
It's number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list and been there for around since the beginning of July. You know, the thing is, this book came out in hardcover last year and got some good media. NBC News did a segment on it. We had videotape of the leader, Doug Coe, talking about modeling his idea of the fellowship into which he brings politicians. He said, you know, a great model is that of Hitler, Himmler, and Goebbels. So we thought we had a real bombshell, and we thought the press would follow up on it, and they just didn't do anything. This year, I think these scandals at the C Street House,
right,
where these three politicians have been involved in sex scandals covering it up, has gotten people's attention. And so we've gotten a lot more media and doing a lot of stuff. So now it's selling like hotcakes. My publisher can't print it fast enough, which is good, because I think here's a group that of very powerful men who sign off on a distortion of religion that is opposed to democracy. They're explicitly opposed to democracy. And I think it's something we need to know about.
Explicitly opposed to the democracy that they are supposedly serving. I mean, there's something really disturbing, very cynical about that.
It's a betrayal of trust. I mean, it's the same betrayal of trust, you know, when Governor Sanford abandons his post. But, you know, you asked in the last segment, you know, let's look at things that they've actually done. And I think that that would, you know, maybe best illustrate it.
But what have they been able to do? What, if they decide, let's do X, have they been able to do that?
Yeah, they really have. Why don't I give some domestic examples and some foreign affairs examples, and that's really where they see their strengths. They began with the idea that they were going to break the power of labor unions. And, of course, labor unions have had corruption in the past, but that's not what their concern was. Their concern was they think any attempt by working people to improve their situation is actually an affront to God. So they had members like Henry Ford and these guys and said, you know, accept your place. So they threw their lobbying muscle into legislation in the late 1947s that rolled back the rights of ordinary working people to get together and advocate for themselves. And they consider that one of their first big victories. They then began moving overseas, and I think one of the ugliest relationships they forged. In 1959, they sent two senators, Senator Frank Carlson and Senator Homer Capehart, and a delegation of American businessmen to interview the dictator of Haiti, a man named Papadoc Duvalier, and conclude whether he was worthy of U.S. support. These are two very powerful senators. They were able to swing that if they thought that he was. They concluded that Papadoc was a man of God, as they put it, and went back and organized the United States to start supporting him. The United States poured money into this regime. This guy was as far from a man of God as can be imagined, starting with the fact that he believed he was God, very literally. He thought he was God, and he ruled through, I mean, this stuff sounds like Dan Brown stuff, but it's history, sadly. He ruled through a vicious militia called the Tonton Macoutes, who were a voodoo army. He believed in voodoo. That was his thing. And just terrorized the people of Haiti. We now know, you know, the United States now considers this guy a complete disaster. No one thinks that was a good idea. They started pursuing that further. There's a dictator in Indonesia, Suharto, the CIA called the coup by which he came to power. The U.S. government said this is one of the worst mass killings in the 20th century. Killed up to, we're not sure how many exactly, up to 1.2 million of its own fellow citizens. The family called that a spiritual revolution, and they began sending over congressmen to meet with him. They even hosted him, and they brought him into the U.S. Senate and arranged meetings for him with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and they lobbied very hard for money to go to him. And that's what they do. They act like a lobby. They don't register as a lobby, but they act like a lobby domestically. I mean, the list goes on of these foreign dictators, but domestically, you look at what they do, and you see one thing that I think is sort of disturbing is a story I tell in the end of the book. We all know about faith-based initiatives in government.
Sure.
And that sounds, you know, that sounds fine enough. You might have, you know, one view or the other on these initiatives. We look in the family's archives and we see that what they really wanted to do, they began talking about this in the early 1980s and thinking about how this could be done. And what they wanted to do was they wanted to take money, taxpayer money, and put it into the hands of their members who they felt would best know how to use it. And, I mean, you don't have to take my word on this. There's a man named David Kuo, not to be confused with Coe. He was as a young congressional aide, he wrote the legislation that allowed faith-based initiatives. His career came through the family. He then went on to serve high in the Bush White House. And he then came to renounce what he had done. He said, "This is we use this for transparent political gain. This was it was a crass power grab. This is not some liberal saying. This is a conservative saying this." He calls the family the most powerful group in Washington that nobody knows. He says their reach into governments around the world is impossible to overstate or even grasp. And There's a conservative sociologist. Again, I make these points because I don't want anyone to think that this is some kind of partisan thing. This is not a left-right issue. This is a secret group issue. Conservative sociologist did a survey of 360 evangelical politicians. Said, "What's the most influential religious group in Washington?" And the family came out on top, which is something for an organization that says it doesn't exist.
Right, it's such a low profile that it's so well known by a certain group of people. So what are some of the things that have been done either by members of the family or done kind of in concert with the goals of the family, which many of us might consider to be crimes, which they look the other way on? Or better, they hear it and they go, "Yeah, well, good. Great. Good job."
They don't look the other way. With these guys like Suharto and so on, they think it's terrific. And an example I tell in the book, there's a contemporary dictator named Museveni in Uganda. They consider him now God's new chosen man for Africa. In 1997, an associate of the family named Dennis Bakke met Museveni through the family. Museveni then gave him, Bakke was a CEO of a giant corporation called AES. Museveni gave him a no-bid contract for a half a billion, that's $500 million, hydroelectric dam that was a complete boondoggle, a complete disaster for the country. They consider that a sign of God's work. Senator Brownback explained to me how this could work. He said, it was a piece of legislation that he's been working on called the Silk Road Act. And a lot of the legislation they work on is stuff that nobody pays attention to. They're talking about the Central Asian Republics, countries a lot of Americans aren't familiar with, but they have a lot of oil, they have a lot of natural gas, they're very important strategically. He said, "What I want to do is I want to funnel U.S. aid to these dictators who run this country." And he's going to work with his brother in the family, a guy named Joe Pitts from Pennsylvania. He says, "This is going to have three advantages." He says, one, it's going to help these dictators fight Islamic radicalism, and that's just the opposite of what happens there, so that's not very effective. He says, two, it's going to open these countries up to American investment. Well, that's fine. Let's take a closer look at that. The company with the biggest interest in that is called Koch Industries, which also happens to be Sam Brownback's biggest financial backer. What's good for them is good for him. He says, three, where American money follows, the gospel follows. or where American money goes, the gospel follows. And you got to remember, when he's talking about the gospel, he's not talking about what you hear on Sundays in church. He's talking about this religion of power. And that's the way that they're pursuing this legislation that expands their influence around the world. And frankly, is contradicts American interests. This is not good for the United States to have these senators playing, you know, rogue maverick policies, promoting this kind of very brutal sort of cult of personality that's endangering the United States. And I think that's a core issue.
Sure. And it's not just senators, too. We should point out there's been quite a few judges that have been associated with the family. So even if something did get to a court somewhere, just like in the old days, perhaps, when somebody flashed a Masonic symbol to a judge, there might be some friendly sort of behind-the-scenes arrangements for family members.
Well, sure. The most famous of them is William Rehnquist, who recently died. Remember the Supreme Court, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who was very powerful for many years. In the archives, we see that he began studying the Bible according to the family, with the family, under their guidance, as early as 1974. Of course, after he died, we learned that he had been addicted to drugs for many years. We got to question this guy's judgment. Another interesting judicial story I found in the archives is the Watergate felon Chuck Colson. Some
yeah.
people may remember him,
sure.
Chuck Colson. Not a religious man, but converted to religion of some sort through the family. Doug Coe, the leader of the group, came and sat down with him and converted him. Did go to prison, committed a felony, was released to the family. And I have the letters from the parole board. They wrote to the parole board saying, release him. We're going to use him to pursue our ends. Now, some people have a lot of respect for Chuck Colson. They say, well, Chuck
yeah.
Colson was reformed. And,
right.
And I
prison evangelist.
Yeah, he's done some good things, but there's a cynicism there. I have a letter in which he says, I discovered that which I could not achieve politically, I could achieve the exact same ends if I called it religion, if I used religion. And you want to say, boy, Chuck, I don't know if you learned your lesson. The idea was not to pursue those exact same ends that got you thrown in prison for
right.
abusing power. The
right.
goal was to learn that there's a different message here. So again and again, they're able to sort of run interference for the members of Congress named Kurt Weldon from Pennsylvania, used an event that they host every year called the National Prayer Breakfast. That sounds innocuous enough. The president always comes and speaks. Most of Congress goes, foreign heads of state. It's in the Washington Hilton. It's a pretty dull affair. What people don't pay attention to is the week-long lobbying fest that goes on around it. Congressman Kurt Weldon certainly did. He used it as an opportunity to bring in two Serbian war criminals with interest to Russian oil, represented by his children, who were lobbyists. And you see this again and again and again, this kind of crass cynicism.
Right.
And I once asked, because I spent a lot of time with him, I asked them, I said, you know, aren't you worried that these guys, let's give you the benefit of the doubt. You have the best of intentions. Aren't you worried that someone's going to use this? And they said, well, I'd rather let in a wolf than keep out a lamb. And you look at their history, and they've got a whole pack of wolves in there.
Right.
And they don't have any. The wolves ate the lambs.
Yeah.
It does become this kind of power call. And on the one hand, you want to say, well, it's just like these guys getting rich. But the frightening thing is that the men at the heart of the group, they really believe this. They really believe in this strange theology of creating a 1,000-year rule of working through strong men and killers. And they say that God has chosen them for this special mission. That's the story I'm trying to tell in the family, not just, you know, political intrigue.
It's the new chosen. That's the way they look at themselves in the family. Jeff Charlotte's the author. So circling back to where we were about this time last hour, we started talking about how they helped to cover up some of these infidelities and, in some cases, what might even be a misappropriation of funds by elected officials when it comes to girlfriends, hookers, that sort of thing. What do you know for sure about what the family has done to try to rehabilitate the chosen members that had chosen badly?
It's an interesting process. You look at they originally called this soul surgery. And the house on C Street, they speak of having soul surgery. And that comes from a place in American history, a guy named Frank Buchman and this group called Moral Rearmament. Buchman had this idea that he could bring wealthy people together and they'd get into a small group and they would begin with a series, a round of sexual confession. You would talk about your sexual sins. Of course, what this does is this bonds you to one another. Senator Brownback explained to me this is, in fact, exactly what they do. And then you might reveal a message one has for the other. Now, I witnessed this on a small scale when I was living with a group. We discussed one man who had been living with them, and just the nightmare scenario. He was engaged. His fiance had been raped, and was in another state, and he wanted to get on the next plane, of course, to fly home to see her. And the men who within this group have veto power over his life, that's what you do. You agree to give the men in your group veto power over his life. They said no. They said if she was raped, that's God's way of telling you that you're not supposed to be with her, that he doesn't want her for you, and you have to ask why. Why was she in a place where she got herself raped? They said she was a Jezebel and that he was not to go to her. Now, that guy had the good sense to say, to heck with that, and walked out the door.
Right.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of tales of sort of small-scale broken lives like that of men where the family, and say, trying to help someone deal with this issue. So for Senator Ensign, who is sleeping with his one of his aides, who was the wife of his best friend. The affair began while they were living in his house because their own house was having some work done. So, you know, his wife and her husband were sound asleep, and they're sneaking off in the corner. He's doing all this while this guy is then going out in the public and proclaiming himself a, you know, good moral man, all this kind of thing. They told him not to do it. They did. We know that they told him not to do it. And they also counseled him to give the mistress money. And his family, a casino fortune in Nevada, gave, we now know, at least $96,000 in small payments so that it wouldn't attract the attention of the IRS. In other words, if you're acting legit, if you're trying to be honest and make amends, you don't do things to hide your money.
Right.
Like that.
And it was actually it was his father and mother who had spontaneously decided to give his mistress money.
Well, spontaneously, the family calls this the man-to-man financial method. They sometimes like to call themselves a Christian mafia, although, as we've discussed, they're not particularly Christian. But they move money around in curious ways. Again, I've been very heartened by the example of the Christian Right magazine, World Magazine, which is a very conservative Christian organization. They look at the finances of this group, and they said, hey, this is really not appropriate. They're moving money in ways that may, in fact, be illegal and so on. But the one thing that they really like to do is they say, let's move money off the books. So if I want to support you, I'm not even going to do it through a formal organization that's accountable, that, you know, people can say, hey, I want to support that or not. Doug Coe, the leader of the group, says, he says, I loan or give money to hundreds of my friends or have my other friends do this. This is a man who's been flying around the world on private jets for decades that are loaned to him, given to him.
Right.
And that's exactly the kind of money movement that we saw in the Senator Ensign case. So when they defend themselves by saying, hey, this is just a personal group and we tried to help him, they tried to help him cover it up and, you know, right down to actually helping him write the breakup letter. And then
we'll get back to this coming up. We're missing it on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So getting back to this, we'll get to more questions and comments from you all as they come in on coasttocoastam.com. The numbers are open, and we hope that you join the conversation here with Jeff Charlotte. And, Jeff, before I get to any of the calls, let me ask you about Heath Shuler. I thought it was interesting. I'm sort of a Vols fan from a long time ago, so I followed his political career a bit. And he himself has yet to confirm that he's a member, or he's a resident at C Street, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he hasn't said he is, but yet other people say that he is.
Well, no, it's a little odder than that. He sure is a North Carolina Democrat. He's a fairly conservative Democrat, but nothing to raise eyebrows. About a month ago, this magazine I've been referring to, World Magazine, this Christian Right magazine, before they launched their own investigation, and they ended up confirming everything I charged, but their first instinct was to say, oh, this is, we're going to circle the wagons. And so they wrote a positive article about C Street, in which they reported that he lived in this C Street house, which has been at the center of these three sex scandals this summer, in this very, very strange set of beliefs. And and there was nothing, no issue there until the scandal started heating up, and then a local paper in Asheville, North Carolina, asked him, and he refused to confirm or deny that he lived there, which is an odd, very odd response. So beyond that, we don't really know. And so I as I said, I'm very careful about talking about who's involved and how. All I know right now is we have this report that he's there, and that he, instead of just being forthright with the voters, is being secretive. And I think that means it's time to ask more questions. I think what's happening is a lot of these guys who get involved marginally, and as more and more is coming out about the really very disturbing teachings at the heart of this group, they're quite disturbed by it. Another Democrat, if you want to talk about Democrat, Senator Mark Pryor of Arkansas, very conservative Democrat, but again, nothing wrong with that. That's fine if one wants to be that. But he had been involved, and I had interviewed him about this 2 years ago for Rolling Stone magazine. And now these scandals are out. Well, suddenly he doesn't want to be associated anymore. So he tells the Arkansas press that I had never spoken to him. I called him up and I said, my editors at Rolling Stone and I are happy to share the transcript of our conversation. In fact, I'm going to be on MSNBC tonight, and I'd be happy, to share this with everybody. Well, they change their tune and they say, okay, all right, you spoke to us. Good, but could you please stop saying that we don't know Doug Coe. We don't want to know Doug Coe, the leader of the family. We don't want to be anywhere near this guy. He keeps talking about the leadership lessons of Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. Please. And, instead of having the integrity to say, hey, here's a group that has outsized influence and I was snookered into it and now I'm going to stand up to it, they're just skedaddling and running.
Well, and I would think that, and this is, and I want to get to the calls right away, but I just would have thought that a senator, a congressman has to submit where they live so that they aren't breaking any rules when it comes to like a favorable lease deal or something. That they
that's
have
exactly
to
what they're getting. They're getting, the family is very explicit about this. They say, we created this to help politicians financially.
Right.
And I would think they're not reporting it.
And I would think they would have to. I mean, if not, they can't list a non-address in Washington. They can't just say, well, I'm sleeping in my car and then secretly be living someplace. I mean, they would just seem to violate law. But anyway, let's go to the wild card line. Jill is in New York for Jeff Charlotte, author of The Family on Coast to Coast AM. Jill?
Hello. Well, all I can say is thank goodness for Coast to Coast. I guess I'm just wondering, it just never ceases to boggle my mind how people can justify anything as even spiritual, because they, you don't want to be in power. I want to, have sex with whoever I want. And my gosh, I'm doing the right thing on top. It's mind boggling. But
right.
I started hearing you speak about this. I thought, well, my gosh, where does this fit in to the Bilderberg Group? Is this just a subset of the Bilderberg Group?
Well, that's an interesting idea. And thank you, Jill. Let me actually run that by Jeff Charlotte. Are there any other of the international groups, the Bilderberg Group is not a mythical group, it's a real group, and this sort of parallels that idea somehow of that secret sharing of international power and influence. Are they affiliated with anybody else, the family?
They show up in all those same circles because we're talking about very, very powerful men. And Doug Coe, the leader of the family, goes to Bohemian Grove and all these kinds of different networks. But,
I think the important
distinction is that those groups are gatherings of elites. Their bottom line is simply sort of you know, what's good for us is good for the world. The family's a little bit different because they really do have a special set of belief systems that they believe that they're working toward this long-term goal. They say the long-term goal is 200 world leaders bound and visibly together in their family to pursue this idea of a 1,000-year government according to their God. I mean, that takes them quite a bit further afield than the Bilderberg group and the Bohemian Grove and that sort of thing. I mean, it's really it's a theology, a religion of power.
Right. Dale is in Tennessee on Coast to Coast AM for Jeff Charlotte. Go ahead, Dale.
Good morning, Ian. How are you doing today?
Couldn't be better. Thank you.
Jeff, a very interesting conversation tonight. But, you know, you're talking about these invisible groups, Ian. How about the elitists, like in the collectivists, like in Freedom Force International and Mr. Griffin talked about? I mean, these are people with real power. I mean, they've been running this country since the late 1800s, early 1900s. And, you know, they've got, like, the Rockefellers and J.P. Morgan kind of people running this stuff, which is a lot more than, yeah, the group you're talking about, I think, has got some power potential, but, you know, some danger potential. But these collectivists have got these guys outnumbered, you know, like 10 to 1.
Well, all right, Dale, let's just pick up then where Dale leaves off and say, what about some of these other big names? What about some of these, the Rockefellers and the big family names, like the Bush family? Any trace of the Bush family?
Rockefeller Sr. Gave some of the seed money to help start the family. Again, that's documented. You go in their own archives and you'll find all the documentation of that. That money is there from the beginning. The Bush family is an interesting case. It's actually Bush Sr. who was more involved. In fact, Bush Sr., 1992, praised Doug Coe, the leader of the family. He says, I want to praise him for not what I'd call, I'm quoting here, this is not quite secret diplomacy, but quiet diplomacy. Well, Bush Sr. seems to have forgotten that that's illegal, according to one of the oldest laws in the book, right. The Logan Act, which forbids diplomacy by private citizens because it's not accountable. You know, you go back and you see names and the history of the family, like Senator Strom Thurmond, Pat Robertson, we all know. Well, his father, Senator Absalom Willis Robertson of Virginia, was a vice president of the organization. You know, and when you say, I think when we say that these guys aren't powerful, I don't quite know what to do with someone.
Right.
How do you answer that when you say these are people who can direct literally hundreds of millions of dollars to a foreign government? These are people who murdered a country, Somalia. They gave, you know, they helped facilitate weapons for Somalia, for Indonesia. They championed Indonesia, this dictator who killed 1.2 million people. That's a lot of dead bodies. And I don't think we can ever turn our eyes away from that. It's so important. I'm not saying that they pulled the trigger. I'm saying that they helped it happen.
I think it's kind of a fool's game to say who's more powerful in these secret organizations. Part of what we know now is that the family has been actually much more effective at keeping themselves secret than other organizations.
Right.
So, I mean, that speaks to their real power, I think, that they've been able to stay out of the limelight.
Yeah, and I think that's a really great point. I mean, this is not a contest, you know, where fans sit there and say, I like the Yankees better than the Red Sox. What we're looking at is that there's multiple bases of power. I think we recognize left, right, middle, everybody recognizes, hey, there's some groups out there that are not playing by the rules and so on, and there's a bunch of them. And instead of saying, hey, this one's on top of that one, let's say, hey, let's shine some sunlight on the whole spectrum.
Right. Sharon's in Manitoba on Coast to Coast AM. Sharon?
Oh, hi, Ian.
Hi.
And hi, Jeff. I think that what you're doing and what Coast to Coast is doing is shining a big, big, huge spotlight on what sounds like a blatant abuse of power. I had listened to you, Jeff, on Canadian National Radio, and I remember the person asking you about the family's influence possibly here in Canada. And I just caught a little bit of it. Is there anything happening here? And hopefully they're not. Well, hopefully their influence doesn't spread here.
And I thanks for listening, Sharon. And unfortunately,
too late.
I have to report my 2-8. One, yeah, they have been involved with Canada for some time. And in fact, actually, after I did that program, I got a lot of great contacts in Canadian politics up there. And all I can say right now is that there's more to come, and hopefully going to be working with CBC, which is, United States listeners, is the big Canadian radio network, to do some more, because there has been some basically anti-small D Democratic influence in Canadian politics. Nowhere near to the extent as here, though. So I suppose that's good news for you.
Right. And yet, I would think that Canada would have been like a 2-foot putt for the family. I mean, they're working on all of these other international groups and everything, that I would think that would have been an easily documentable extension.
Well, it would, but I got to tell you, when I'm looking at, as I was doing this research and going through these 600 boxes of documents, and I literally spent years working with researchers, I really had to choose where I was going to put my energy. So I focused on Germany because I was very interested in their involvement in whitewashing the records of former Nazis, like Hermann J. Abbs, who became vice president of their German organization, until he was exposed as Hitler's banker and had to withdraw from public life. And I focused on these two examples I gave, Somalia and Indonesia, both countries that are involved in because of oil. There's oil there. There's strategic interest. I didn't end up writing about Brazil, for which they ended up championing a junta of dictatorial generals, and they helped funnel billions of dollars to that that regime and so on. I hope someone else will pick up on that. I didn't focus on their role in South Africa and the apartheid government there. But there's more work to be done. And one of the great things about you do a book like this, and other
your publisher's going to pony up a lot of extra money to do the next book.
Well, I hope other people are. You know, what's exciting to me is to see, even domestically, what's been great is since I've been reporting on this, now I'm starting to see local reporters in places like Wichita, Kansas, and Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Jackson, Mississippi, and they're going and doing the work themselves for their local papers, their local TV stations, and going and really holding their elected representatives accountable and saying, look, you know, I believe in freedom of religion. You can believe in whatever you want, but if you are going to be a part of a cult that thinks that Hitler, Stalin, and Mao are the best way to understand Jesus, you ought to tell the voters about that and let them decide if that's something they want to support.
Wildcard Line, Randy is in South Carolina on Coast to Coast AM for Jeff Charlotte. Randy?
Good morning, Ian. It's nice to talk to you. I had a question about a pretty shady character, but I always thought he was a pretty good guy. It was Charlie Wilson. I hope his name is not involved with the family.
Yeah. I have good news for you. Charlie Wilson is not involved. Yeah, interesting character because he's worked behind the scenes, as we saw in Charlie Wilson's War. But no, not a part of the family.
Probably too many big busted women in hot tubs, even for the family. What do you think?
Charlie Wilson liked the good times. We can say that for him.
Interesting. Thank you, Randy. Caroline is in Pennsylvania on Coast to Coast AM. Carolyn or Caroline?
I'm Caroline.
Okay, go ahead.
Thanks for asking. Hey, good morning, gentlemen. This group sounds like it's just one tentacle of an octopus-type organization, because it sounds like all the same handful of people are in this group, and the Bilderbergers and CFRs, and you know, a lot of same names come up. But what I wanted to ask you about or tell you about was a short while ago there was a guest on the show who was an expert in backwards messages on records, and he talked about how Madonna's records from the early on in her career always had backwards satanic messages. And some of the messages were "All hail the family" and "I love Satan." And I was wondering if you had ever heard of that, and if you had any comments.
I'm not familiar with that. What I can address is what's been interesting about my research on the family is discovering that there's a certain number of self-described Christian fundamentalists. I say that with, that's just how they understand themselves. And they believe, and I'm not saying this is so, but they believe that Doug Coe, the leader of the group, is the Antichrist. They look at this guy with this just tremendous international access. And I have to say, He is one of the most charismatic men I've ever met. And when you're with him, everything he says makes sense. And then you walk away and you're kind of shaking your head and you go, wait a minute, and as if a fog is lifting. So there are people who see, certainly see that this is, they see it in more than political terms, but as you say, it's almost, it's much darker and satanic terms almost.
Has Doug Coe advocated for the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem? That's a serious question.
Yeah. No, we haven't. One of the interesting things about the family, when we look at the history of Christian conservatives in the United States, is it's traditionally been very supportive of Israel. And the family is different in that regard. You might have gotten a clue from their involvement with former Nazis after World War II. They're not, don't have that same relationship with Israel. In fact, I would say one of their early policy defeats is that they threw all their political muscle into the opposition of the formation of Israel in the late 40s. And they are much more interested in making friends with these Muslim dictators like Zahardo and Siad Barre.
That's very interesting. And that, I would think, would be an important revelation for voters in many of the states where these C Street members are originate, that they would, the voters would want to know that the organization through, you know, whose largesse they are living in Washington, that that organization is anti-Israel, or at least sort of openly supportive of Israel's enemies. I would think, again, that these are things that voters have a right to know, if it's true, and to what degree the senator knows about it or is trying not to know about it, which may be the other thing about the members of the C Street group. All right, so we'll get back to this. More of your calls. Hang on, Tom's in Toronto on the international line, and the rest of the calls lining up next. I'll give you the numbers if you want to join the conversation, too, with Jeff Charlotte from the new book, The Family. Well, the new paperback book, The Family, on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, let's go back to the phone calls right away, as so many people have been holding to talk with Jeff Charlotte. The Family is the subject of the new book. Tom is in Toronto on the international line on Coast to Coast AM for Jeff Charlotte. Go ahead, Tom.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you for this opportunity. I just want to ask you, Jeff, you mentioned Somalia, Ethiopia, and Uganda in Africa. How about Eritrea and President Isaias? They want to get rid of them. Can you, do you have any knowledge about that place?
Did you say Eritrea?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the family has been very close links with the Ethiopian government for a long time. Of course, as we know, Ethiopia and Eritrea have been at odds for a long time. So that's not been a friendly relationship. They put their money on Ethiopia until there was, of course, the horrible communist regime, the Red Terror in Ethiopia, which allied itself with the Soviet Union instead. But no special links to Eritrea except a preference for Ethiopian power in the region and at any cost.
And that could change. Thanks, Tom. Let's get to Mark in Houston, east of the Rockies, on Coast to Coast AM for Jeff Charlotte. Mark?
Good morning, Ian and Jeff. Some of the other folks that have called in have described this as interesting and fascinating topic. I find it frigging incredible. This family sounds almost like the Christian version of Muslim extremists. I had two questions for you, but your call screener said that one of them that I was going to ask is going to be asked by somebody else. I haven't heard it yet, so I hope it's still going to be in the queue. But the second is, how did you get such unfettered access to the inner sanctum of this organization if they knew you were a writer?
It was precisely because I was a writer that I think they thought I was interesting. Most of the men who lived with me in Ivanwald were from fairly affluent families, fairly influential families. They came from around the world. There was a young man from the Czech Republic who'd been sent there by his father, a very wealthy businessman, made contact, same another guy from Ecuador there for the same reason. I am not from a wealthy family, just a middle-class family. But because I was a journalist, they thought that I was going to sort of be an influencer on their behalf. And frankly, I should also add that my father was an academic. He studied the Soviet Union. and would on occasion lecture at the CIA. So they saw me as sort of part of an establishment that I'm not actually part of. My father was really just a small town professor, but that allowed me to do it. And then over the years, of course, they had this archive that I was able to Xerox tens of thousands of documents from.
Well, you know, I want to go back to the CIA connection. We barely mentioned that. But there is a kind of a long history, isn't there, of a CIA involvement in the family or vice versa?
Yeah, and intelligence. I mean, you almost sort of, this gets into this interesting story. The FBI in the United States is famously and historically linked to Fordham University in New York, which is a Catholic university. It tends to be working class guys, historically, and Catholic. The CIA tends to be upper crust, elite, famously linked to Yale, Yale University, and Protestant, although, again, with no disrespect to all our Protestant friends, because what these guys are really doing is not even Christian. There have been a lot of links over the years, and one of the things that the family early on realized that they could do to have influence in foreign countries is that they could identify a man in a U.S. embassy overseas who could almost simultaneously be working for the United States and working for them. And they've had a lot of that, people who are double-dipping on both payrolls, and that's a security problem. But if they could do that, then they would have access to that government, and oftentimes that would be the intelligence officer assigned to the embassy in Greece and Spain, around the world.
It seemed like the list I was looking at, again, it's on Wiki, so I don't know how accurate it is, but it seemed to be kind of, at least in some part, kind of a who's who in intelligence. West of the Rockies in California, it's Jarrett for Jeff Charlotte on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Jarrett.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Great, Jarrett.
Jeff, my question is in regards to Blackwater, or now called Z Services. From what I understand, the owner or guy who operates that company is sort of a crazy right-wing Christian type guy. And are there any coalition
there's some
there?
Connections. There's somebody that's a guy named Eric Prince in the Prince family, which is very wealthy, very secretive, and gives money to causes they support. And there has been some Prince money for the family over the years. But I do tend to think those as two separate power bases. One of the distinctions is that Eric Prince considers himself, as we now know, to be waging a sort of holy war against Islam. We now know that he believed in not so much liberating Iraq as just simply killing Iraq. It seemed to be what he was saying there in the latest disclosures. The family, meanwhile, is interested. As I say, we build new power where we can, or work with power where we can, build new power where we can. They're more interested in forging alliances with powerful leaders who are going to be useful to them, and they don't really care what those people believe, whether they're Quranic Marxist, as was Siad Barre, or a Muslim authoritarian, as like Suharto, or a Christian fundamentalist like Museveni. That power is the bottom line for them, so they're a little bit different than Eric Prince. But as we discussed earlier, it's important to recognize that there's more than one group here, and the problem is how they all work together.
First-time caller line, Dustin is in Illinois on Coast to Coast for Jeff Charlotte.
Thank you, gentlemen, for both your work. I believe I'm going to ask that gentleman's first question I called a little bit earlier. When we're looking at Nazi Germany and the fascists in Italy and even the CIA recently, does the family have ties, which I'm assuming they do, to the black arts, meaning the like MK Ultra and Project Monarch, and creating these leaders, but also controlling, like, mind control type techniques, and when they deal with the prostitutes, so to speak, they're creating these people that all integrate with one another. And
let's get to that. Just the idea of even mind control techniques. Do they do anything like that?
Well, there's a lot of aspects of life within the organization that are cultish and really do resemble what we think of, use a popular figure of speech, brainwashing. They talk about when you get a politician involved or just a guy like I was, when they said they want to take that personality and they want to break it. They're going to break you down until you are nothing. And they'll emphasize this again and again. You are nothing. You are nothing. You are just a tool. You need to accept the fact that you're just a tool. On one hand, of course, this really just breaks a person's spirit. On the other other hand, what it does is it gives these powerful figures within it a kind of a get-out-of-jail card. I mean, Senator Enkin and Governor Sanford could say, well, I'm nothing. I didn't do this. I don't do anything. I guess God is what wanted he wanted this to happen for some reason. So there is that element. And, you know, I saw one young guy who was in the group. This guy early 20s. And he'd gone off to college, and he had partied a little too hard, and his parents had spoken with a congressman, Steve Large, and arranged for him to go off and live at Ivanhoe. He was a young guy, and you know, in his case, it was just fine. He got himself straightened out, got disciplined, was ready to go back and resume his life in the world, and the family said, "No, no, and if you go, we're going to tell your family, your parents, that you are banished, and they're not to speak to you again." And they agreed to that. And this got to be very cultish, and that, you know, they were really trying to exert control over his sense of self, and it was a sad story.
Alex is in Texas on Coast to Coast AM for Jeff Charlotte. Alex?
Hi, Jeff. I'm a long-time listener and a first-time caller. I'm very impressed about the research that you have done. The family, I have actually some experience with the family and know some about it. I think that a positive spin or a positive work that the family has done is worked very effectively with leaders, not only domestically but also internationally, bring some more people to God. They're Christ-centered. They work in small cell groups. They work very effectively to counsel or disciple some of these people to the Lord.
Well, Alex, I have to ask you then, why keep it secret?
The reason to keep it secret is that to have access to the leaders, both domestically and internationally, you have to be invisible because of the publicity that these people have, you know, in their sphere of influence. So to have access to these people and to work with them effectively, you have to keep it,
You have to be invisible. You just said that you have to be invisible.
Yes, correct.
Okay, so you're calling to confirm what I'm saying, that this is a secretive group, that they believe that they have to be invisible. And Alex, I understand and I respect that you see the good intentions of the group, but we live in a democracy. We live in a democracy where you don't get to do things behind the scenes and say, well, I'm powerful and you little people don't understand. You have to be transparent. And you know, there's so many great religious groups, conservative, liberal, everything else, they do what they do in public. And they say, look, you want to look at our tax records and who we give money to and who we get money from? You can do that. The family isn't doing that. They're not living up to basic standards of accountability. So even if you thought they were doing the best work in the world, you got to be accountable to the public. It's really, that's the foundation of democracy.
Hey, Alex, why do you think the family should be able to play by their own rules?
I believe they know it to be effective in what they're doing and to access the
I didn't ask you that question. Why do you think they should be allowed to play by their own rules? We all want to be effective organizations, right? We all want to do that. So just be wanting to do that doesn't give you the right to do it.
Why should they be
different?
Right. You know, and I understand your point of view and I understand, you know, Jeff's point of view. I don't believe that, you know, they should be excluded from following the
rules. Okay. All right. Good. Know, then we can end on a good note that you don't believe that they should be excluded from the rules either. Let's go to Andrew in Los Angeles. Oh, sorry, Carrie in North Carolina first, and then Andrew in L.A., and then whoever we can get on after that. Carrie?
Hi. Well, hopefully if their power is based on their secrecy and their effectiveness, maybe by Mr. Charlotte's work exposing them, we can try to stop them. I think this is a great show tonight that everybody needs to tune into and take very seriously. Mr. Charlotte, I heard you a few months ago and did a little research of my own into it, and I wanted to see if you could talk a little more about some of the domestic cells that the family allies itself with, such as, for example, one of the ones I found was the Denver Leadership Foundation and the Young Life Incorporated out of Colorado, and the links to Jerome Lewis, of former Petro Lewis fame, and the American Petroleum Institute, and lots of other big
nice
oil
work.
Interests.
Nice.
Yeah.
You're absolutely correct about all that. That's very impressive, and I hope you will go to my website, jeffcharlotte.com, and get in touch with me, because I would like to get in touch with you. Yeah, there's Jerome Lewis is an oil man who's given them a lot of money over the years. There's a lot of what's interesting about the family is that they've created state level organizations around the country. So in Colorado, almost at every state, they created these governor's prayer breakfasts, an annual event the governor attends. Again, on the surface, it seems pretty innocent, but it's used by the people around it as a lobbying festival, as a way of getting access to power, as the previous caller said, invisibly and secretively, and that's how you have to get access to power. And they've been doing this in Colorado. Another one I've been looking at is out in California, where this is great news as far as I'm concerned. The guys taking the lead on the fight against this is a Christian organization. They also want to have access to power. They also want to be able to influence congressmen or politicians, state politicians, for their version of Christ. But you know what? They do it publicly. And if you want to see their financial records, they show them to you. If you want to know what they believe, they're glad to tell you. So they've been taking the lead on fighting the influence of the family in California because they're saying these guys aren't democratic. It doesn't matter if you're left or right. In a democracy, we do things out in the open. Same thing out there in Denver, and I would love to be in touch with you more and learn about your research.
Andrew is in L.A. Wild Card Line as our time is dwindling with Jeff Charlotte on Coast to Coast. Andrew?
Hi, Ian. Hi, Jeff. Great job, Jeff. Question to you is twofold. Number one, are there any evangelists or tele-evangelists who are associated or behind the scenes working along with this organization? And number two, does this not sound like something like when you were talking about earlier, something like the Shades of the New World Order or just another?
Actually, funny you should mention New World Order, Jeff. Go ahead.
Yeah, New World Order going back to 1945, the end of World War II. The founder of the group, Abraham Baraiti, said we are entering a new world order. He used the term that early. He said the D-Day has come. They later coined a term they called worldwide spiritual offensive on behalf of this new world order. And again, when we talk about that thousand-year government they're building, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? That kind of thing.
East of the Rockies, Steve is in Florida on Coast to Coast AM for Jeff Charlotte. Steve?
Hey, real quick, what do you know about Bill Nelson and his wife's involvement with that group?
Yeah, quite a bit, actually. A former member of the group who had been quite influential in it until he realized what they were really doing, and he was an honest Christian man, and he quit. He'd been a very prominent lawyer in Florida politics, and he shared his archive with me, which included extensive papers of Bill Nelson, who was a Democrat from Florida. Pretty hapless guy, I got to say. Bill Nelson is not the brightest bulb on the porch. His wife is widely considered the brains behind that operation. She has been very influential, and in fact, was my researchers and I interviewed her for the book. She was involved with creating a prayer cell around Hillary Clinton, of all people. And Hillary Clinton, by own admission, when she came to Washington, had a prayer cell organized for her by Doug Coe. Of women with whom she shared very few political affiliations, mostly conservative women. But the Nelsons, they were in power, they lost power, they turned to the family, they sort of got a hold of the Florida State prayer breakfast and organizing that, and were able to use that to sort of lobby themselves back into power and do it quietly behind the scenes. And Grace Nelson said as much herself. She said, you know, anyone can join as long as they obey Jesus as we understand them. That was in effect her argument.
Everybody can join except her because she's a woman.
Oh, women can be part of it, but they have different roles. You have to understand.
Right. I understand.
But there's always a few women because in the same way that they're happy to work with a Muslim dictator, if there's a woman who's very powerful, it's that power that's always the bottom line for them.
Our bottom line is we have about 20 seconds for Jean in California, so she's got to be super fast. Jean? You're going to get one chance here for a question.
Real quick, Jeff. What do you think about Lauren Cunningham's involvement in the whole Christian organization called YWAM?
YWAM actually owns the deed to the C Street House, and we're starting to do some investigations into them. There's been allegations of running orphanages where rape is involved in Thailand and Brazil and so on. So YWAM is linked in, and that's a great question. That's the next story.
Okay. Jeff, I want you to raise your right hand and pledge to me that this won't be the last we hear from you.
I promise you, there's more to come.
I think it's fascinating. If you'll pardon me, and I know a little bit about where you stand religiously, but I will just say, I think you're doing God's work.
Thank you. Thank you. And I very much appreciate that.
And I just I hope you help. If nothing else, keep these guys honest, and we'll be watching the latest on the family. We'll get back to it sometime soon, I know. Jeff Charlotte, that's the book. Link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. In the meantime, Deus Tamat, and I do too.